I'm Mindy.
And I'm Darren.
And we are the Rance Macabre, covering all things horror.
With every episode, we explore the genre with sharp focus and deep production.
We want you to love scary movies as much as we do, so we don't overshare plots or give spoilers.
Welcome back, listeners.
Yes.
To part two of our Sounds of Horror.
Yeah.
We haven't really... We've always had like little corners, and you give us a lesson in music theory and tritones and what makes for a scary piece of music, unsettling
right.
particularly. But this time, this is a whole episode on yeah. a couple horror classics. We're going to be talking about a couple famous themes and influences, and wind up on some classics, what everybody kind of bases their own stuff on.
Yeah, it seems like. Maybe you could call Bernard Herrmann the Bach of horror music, movie music.
You could say that.
You could say that.
If you were so inclined.
One might say that.
Out the gate, we are jumping right into the Friday the 13th. Theme.
Yeah.
And so historically you're not a fan of any of these in the series.
Nope.
I feel bad because like between this and Halloween, like not your favorite
it's
films.
Just not my thing.
No. And
that's okay. There's plenty of other films for me to enjoy.
Last episode we talked about how I don't know if it's necessarily your favorite, but you do prefer like a jukebox style soundtrack.
I do.
Where
yeah.
they use pop music of the time.
I like that. Yeah. I enjoy that a great
movies
deal.
Movies like Fright Night or Scream.
Exactly. Yeah.
So for Friday the 13th being like a pretty bare bones, you know, sort of archetypal slasher, not exactly the introduction of Jason, but certainly the like POV mm-hmm. hunt and the thematic music that accompanies that by Henry Manfredini. There's production to it, especially at a time where like things were definitely going the way of the synth.
Yes.
And it's funny how like associated in my mind synth music is with slasher films.
Because it's inexpensive. Because you right. don't need the whole orchestra. You can have one guy sitting in a room. I mean, that's why we yeah. have some of that great music for X-Files. Is Chris Carter was not allowed to have full orchestral scores.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he said, you got to keep it simple. Keep it to yourself.
Yeah.
You can do it in your living room.
If memory serves, Mark Snow, I mean, it, you know, something like Friday the 13th predates it. And
sure.
Halloween as well. But like what we're talking about are home studios
mm-hmm.
where musicians could promise like faster turnaround because it was a much simpler task. Although I wonder, we'll talk about it more when it comes to John Carpenter, but like doing a home recording to score a scene, I guess they had like an early VHS cut of the film on hand, because otherwise
so.
Like that's kind of a nightmare to score to picture. But in any case, Manfredini's piece is kind of a blend in terms of like using early home production stuff, hardware specifically. I'm thinking of the vocal, but those vocalizations, he was running through an Echoplex, which is like your old school studio delay, where it's running little bits of tape, depending on the mm-hmm. the length of the delay, whether it's, you know, a whole note, quarter note, etc. But it's got these independent wound pieces of tape that just record and play and record and play. And these kinds of things broke down a lot. It's not really convenient, but it was the first like portable home studio style kind of effect
mm-hmm.
that is where delay plays up a lot in horror themes.
Yes.
We find it a whole lot. Before we jump forward, just a little bit about Harry Manfredini. Now, he's still working. Like,
yes.
he's still alive and kicking out the jams. He, as a composer, he's got 167 credits. And in all fairness, about every 10th credit is someone reusing the Friday the 13th theme, for which, you know, he's going to get...
Making those residuals, man.
I hope so, because this guy's still, like, a couple projects every year. In his IMDb profile, it says he is a motion picture composer on the same style as Bernard Herrmann. I always want to say Herman, but Bernard Herrmann of the famous Hitchcock team up. But beyond that, he's we're going to talk about him in depth later. But I think, did you call him the Bach?
Yes, I called him the Bach.
The Bach of film scoring?
I think, yeah, we could say that.
Yeah, he's certainly been
he's making the rules and people are taking the things from him.
Yeah.
Borrowing
liberally.
Homage.
Yeah. So Manfredini comes from a jazz background, you let me know. And I know that John Williams, before Spielberg plucked him to score his films, John Williams also came from a jazz background. And my, like, layman's understanding of what it means to be, like, a professional jazz musician, like, there is a tremendous amount of education before one arrives at professional jazz musician.
Right. There's so many people who, see, for me, I don't care for jazz. I just don't care for it. And I know lots of people like to sit and listen to it. And I find it really interesting that the people who want to sit and listen to it are people who don't understand music theory. And that's fine. Like, you don't have to enjoy something. But, like, the point of jazz is the complex musical theory.
Okay. I was going to joke and say that, like, you could even be the layman and appreciate the notes they're not playing.
It's in between the notes. Especially some of the later kind of jazz when you get into Jaco, stuff like that. I really don't understand. Stuff? Yeah. Mm. When you really get into some of the fusion and stuff, I don't get it. But I think the reason so many become composers or are also composers is because they have this complex knowledge of music theory.
And it's hard to find a gig. Do you think their familiarity with time signatures that are atypical beyond standard 4/4 that plays into it? I think because 4/4 is so ubiquitous in pop music, hearing something that is not can sometimes catch the ear and set you off balance a little bit.
No, I would say the complexity of their music is really doesn't come from so much the rhythmic complexity, because it still is always a basic kind of rhythm, even if they're playing with multiple meters. And you have to understand, too, very primitive early music, or a lot of times then sometimes what people call, like, your old traditional drum beats, they're going to be in a mixed meter. And they didn't know anything about music theory. It's just what came to them.
Okay.
So I would say that's not really where they're relying on their skills. It's all in the tonality and the way that they're using the notes and the phrasing rather than the rhythmic complexity.
Okay. In working on this episode, I discovered that I am certainly, I like pop music. Not that I listen to the radio, but, like, I like a pop song. I like the form.
It's called pop because it's popular. People like it.
Right.
There's nothing wrong with that.
So, like, I dig a riff. I like a good riff.
Oh, yeah.
I like a signature sound.
I like a verse, chorus, verse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I would hire the Ramones to score my horror movie. Why not? But, yeah, no. So, I like the atmospheric stuff, but I think of it more as sound design. Mm-hmm. Whereas, like, I do appreciate hearing, like, a character theme.
Yeah.
And if you can recognize that theme later in the piece, then, like, that is, you know, that is a win.
Yes.
On the composer side. So we're not sure if this is going to work, but the idea is to do a listen along and kind of, I'm going to, I guess, ask some questions. We're going to point out some stuff, kind of play Mystery Science Theater for the Friday the 13th Harry Manfredini score. This is specifically the theme. Okay, so I definitely get the
Psycho.
Herman.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I would believe if someone said that they borrowed this from the Psycho soundtrack, I would believe that, and they just added the vocal components.
How much does this even sound like the driving music?
Yeah,
right?
I was thinking. Yeah.
Here we got this is the Psy theme, which we'll talk about later on.
Okay.
You hear the big horns.
Yeah. I'm even thinking the opening credits of maybe it's North by Northwest, I'm thinking of.
Oh, no, North by Northwest. You're right, where he's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is pretty traditional, like, use of strings and stabbing sounds. And
right.
Kind of using the horns to like, build up tension.
And synth horns are so funny because they're so splatty. Yeah. Like, blah, blah.
So that was a short and sweet one.
It is really a rhythmically complex kind of sound because you have that driving oompa, oompa, oompa on the horns always coming back on the and beat or the okay. upbeat. So you get that makes a manic feel because
yeah.
you know
yeah.
that it's not the downbeat. So you get this anxiety kind of that comes from it where, you know, we're used to that upbeat in certain types of music and it doesn't give us that anxiety like Sublime. Something like that. It relies on that upbeat. Everything's on the up.
Oh, well, like ska style.
Yeah.
The strumming.
But it can turn, depending on the tempo or depending on the tonality, it can be soothing and laid back, or it can be driving and manic. And in this case, we have it used as a manic
and
tool.
So are you, you're describing the horns?
Yeah,
that are
the, where it's going.
Keeping
mm-ba, mm-ba, mm-ba.
Okay. Manfredini scored Friday the 13th 1 through 6. I don't know how much new work he was doing with each of those, but...
I don't know. That's like the people who like wrote Leprechaun 1 through 5 million. Like, no, you didn't.
And then he came back for 9 and 10. Yeah, I don't know. I guess in the way that like the Halloween theme has been rejiggered and re-recorded, I'm sure Manfredini earned his money and sort of changed things, although I do not know what he added or took away from the original theme. But
what the joy of these kind of themes is, though, is, and we'll, when we talk about Nightmare on Elm Street, we'll really get into it, is like it is a 9-note theme and you have taken those 9 notes apart and you are just making different things with those notes.
You're
and you can do a whole
point,
film.
But... Yeah,
with 9 notes. It's like if we would put it in more modern times, it's like, you know how Green Day made Dookie and they knew like 4 chords, but they have this whole album, you know?
Okay.
And it's all based just around those 4 chords. And that's kind of like Nightmare, especially because it's really based on a very limited vocabulary theme. And then he's made all this shenanigans around it, which is amazing.
That's I could see working like that. Like, I have a very limited knowledge of music, but I do like to dabble, and so I kind of I'll write bits and pieces and
right.
see where they apply, and kind of do a lot of the music making I do is kind of jigsaw puzzling.
Yeah, because you take it apart, you remix it, you invert. Let's say if it's a sequence, you'll invert the sequence. You know, it's very cool. It's a very smart way to work. But like, so Manfredini, you know, he's, well, number one, he's very much using the psi motif, which we'll talk about in Psycho. That's a big kind of thing from it. And he's using all these minor seconds that you hear, that's kind of that crunchy kind of sound, and that's in some of the drones in the synth, the
okay.
high crunch kind of sounds. So he's using these minor seconds, and it's not to say like, you can't say, oh, someone stole those minor seconds from somebody. I mean, no one owns them. No. But it's like, oh, it gives you this idea, and it harkens back to a older time of music or something from the 50s and 40s.
Okay, so transitioning to, I guess, Jason's counterpart, Freddy, in Nightmare on Elm Street.
His funnier, more
livelier,
dynamic.
Yeah, he's certainly the Bugs Bunny to Jason's, what are we going to, Yosemite Sam? Who's Jason?
Porky
no,
Pig.
Is he the big red monster because he doesn't talk?
Oh, yeah, maybe.
Nightmare on Elm Street, scored by Charles Bernstein. Now, you hear Bernstein in print, it looks like Bernstein, and he's a composer, and you figure, ah, good lineage, and then, no, this Bernstein's from Minneapolis.
Yeah, you're like, nepotism, but no.
Right, no. So, kind of a savant, he was composing orchestral music as a teenager, and then he got into home recording very early when home studios were growing. I found a really great interview on manisthewarmestplacetohide.com,
which is a lovely title for a site.
Yeah, a little long, but
I
mean,
like it. I like
it.
I think it's just long enough.
Okay, so before we jump into his works, his IMDb bio page is very sweet, almost saccharine, written like by a loving mother or a really overzealous agent. This is a section that talks about his work, and you'll get why I'm bringing it up. His impressively eclectic musical style ranges from comedy to drama to action to horror. Bernstein has supplied the scores for a bunch of enjoyably down and dirty 70s drive-in exploitation features, colon. He turned up the funk with That Man Bolt. Went all groovy for The Invasion of the Bee Girls.
Not some groovy, all groovy.
Went all out. All the groove. All the groovy. Invasion of the Bee Girls. I don't know. Blind Melon biopic?
I kind of like it.
And kicked out the jams in the tuneful, swinging country jams of White Lightning. A snippet of this score was used in Kill Bill Volume 1. Also, Gator, A Small Town in Texas, and A Nightmare in Baddam County. Bernstein's scores in the horror genre are especially chilling and effective. Among his finest fright film scores are Hex, Sweet Kill, The Entity. This is one of Bernstein's most inspired, inventive, and underrated scores. It was nominated for a Saturn Award for Best Music. Also, Cujo, Wes Craven's terrifying classic, A Nightmare on Elm Street.
Why isn't lead with that?
I don't know.
Okay, all right, sorry.
Because I think a grandma wrote this. A grandma agent wrote this. Sure, sure. Nightmare on Elm Street and April Fool's Day. Moreover, Bernstein has done scores for a large number of made-for-TV movies, et cetera, et cetera. But okay, so
sure, sure. Well, that's nice.
Yeah.
If I had an IMDb, I would want it to be so nice and have like it sound like my grandma wrote it for me.
I might trim a few of the adjectives just, you know, for expediency. But okay, so for the like music synthesizer nerds, of which I'm sure there's a couple who listen to this, I like this stuff. I don't get obsessive, but so the interviewer says, let's talk about synthesizers for a moment.
They synthesizer people love to talk about their gear.
The interviewer is very excited to talk about synthesizers. He says, I was under the impression that you had used a Prophet 5 as one of your primary instruments, but recently saw a gear list of the soundtrack that included a Yamaha DX7. DX7 was one of the very first digital synthesizers, pure digital.
I do not know anything about synthesizers. I know about Moogs.
Okay. Oberheim OBSX, Roland Juno 106, and a few others. And okay, so Bernstein corrects him and he says, there wasn't a Prophet 5. That's actually one of my favorites. Like, still to this day, the sounds are pretty fantastic. But a child of that one called the Pro 1, an Emu SP12. I don't remember if that's a sampler. That might be a drum sampler. And he mentioned some Roland drum machines. Those will come back in a chat with John Carpenter's details. But Bernstein later says, honestly, at the time that I did the first Nightmare on Elm Street, there was no sense in the composing community of a shift from orchestral to home-based scoring. It was only later that this began to be perceived as a trend among most of us working in the field. I had been using home studio-based techniques since the early 70s. This approach can provide for more personal experimentation and exploration of sounds and possibilities. That sounds right, considering that Nightmare on Elm Street theme kind of like comes in and out with the main theme. Then you hear snippets, mm-hmm. passages, those kind of reappear oftentimes like under different textures and played through a different instrument.
Right. So the way that he kind of composed this Nightmare on Elm Street theme is this 9-note sequence. And we don't relate it to something like 12 tone. We don't call it something like that because we do repeat notes in this sequence, but it's these 9 notes. Once he got those approved by Wes Craven, then he could take it and make all these what kind of like Schoenberg refers to as like liquidation of the series. And okay. So that's where you get like maybe you'll only hear 5 of the notes, maybe you'll only hear 3 of them, maybe you'll play them backwards and kind of a thing. So I don't know, do you want to hear it on the piano? Do you want to hear kind of where it comes from?
Yeah.
Let's take a trip already, listeners. Here we go.
All right, so Mindy is at the piano. I'm holding a mic. So within the theme, there is a piano part. It's not always present, but certainly the theme gets played on the piano. At some point, there's underlying synth sounds and some weedy synths. I thought I even heard a theremin in there, or a synth like doing a theremin equivalent kind of sound. But Mindy's at the piano.
Yeah, this is what we see here. What I have in front of me is like a basic what's kind of essentially like a reduction version for the piano. It lives on, you'll see all these whole notes, all this tied note work. And that's because it's living on these drones. And so that's what you're hearing in synth and theremin and everything. You're just hearing these drones. And the D is kind of just living there. It's part of it. And then, you know, he'll add something to the top for a second. Right. Then we hear something drop in. That's fine. That's great. That's tonal. That's great. Hear what he's going to do next, though. So the equivalent from that A to that E flat that we just heard, it sounds weird. It sounds kind of spooky. That's your tritone. One, two, three, four. It's an augmented fourth, which is your tritone. So we hear it in, it's kind of a backwards version. And you hear that crunch in there. You hear that kind of where the sounds vibrate back and forth. That kind of makes our ears want to resolve it. And because Bernstein's being really kind, he does resolve it up to the B flat. And that's what we hear in that big grand opening.
Is that what stops it from being a tritones piece, that it does resolve?
Well, I mean, tritone is just literally the interval, right? And so what stops, though, that vibration or that fight that pretty much anyone who's grown up with Western music hears, we just hear it because that's in our ears, is the resolution. That's what brings it full front. So which is nice, right? Then you're not left hanging. If not, we would be left hanging with something like, kind of give me the resolution. Thank you. I love that. All I want is a nice resolution.
And I like a bookend.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So then what we have is this main theme. And the main theme, it's this 10-note kind of theme. And what we hear is, so that's the main theme. Then he kind of liquidates that and he uses it differently all throughout. And we hear it then on these synths and he'll bring it up an octave. He'll give us some extra. It's still the theme, but it's like mixed all up. But do you hear that it's the same theme?
I wondered about that. There are points in the piece that it feels like he just dragged his elbow across the lower notes. Like it's kind of like a wrenching the car off the side of the road kind of theme.
So he does that and you see, I mean, he does it at the end, but he also does it because there's this spooky theme, this big 10 note theme. Then there's this major. So that's all in this kind of minor theme. There's this major theme, which I think sounds like a child's theme. Right? So he takes this theme, then what you're hearing is that glissando to get back in. It gets back into the other theme. He uses the glissando to go from that child's theme to get back on the D on the bottom.
Okay, so listening back to the theme. Okay, so that's the whole thing.
So he gives you that theme, the whole thing.
Okay.
And then he's going to fragment it. Because what you cannot do in this kind of music, in series music or in sequence music, you can't give person part of it. You must like give them the whole thing so they understand the sequence. Then you can change it up.
Okay. And so I guess those, I think what we're listening to, the main theme is 4 minutes, 6 seconds. So it feels like two different pieces of music. I wonder if we're, in terms of the movie, whether we just kind of sat through the opening credits or like that's the moment where the title screen is up, because now we're kind of returning to the,
to all the drones.
Yeah. And we've got that. It doesn't even sound like a kick drum that's got the
sounds
delay
like a basketball.
It does sound like a basketball bouncing. And so we've got
we hear that
synth pads.
We hear that wave in the synth, because that's those seconds in the tritones bouncing off each other gives you that wah 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 wah.
Bouncing off each other like a basketball. All right, so this is what I was talking about in terms of like sounding like he.
And now we hear the child's theme.
Yeah.
It's the only time we're major. Now we're suddenly back in the minor, back in that dreamscape with that big D as your pedal tone right there.
Okay, that's the drone. Mm-hmm. That's the synth pad underneath. And so now we've gotten the theme on the synth where it was originally on a piano. I should have been paying closer attention.
It was on a synth, another kind of synth.
Oh, was it?
Another sound.
We've got the child's song riff.
In the very top, it's really hard to hear. You can hear the theme. It's very, very high. Do you hear it? G sharp.
I don't think I do.
It's really, really high. So it's now layered. There's about three layers going on.
But we're getting...
You hear the child's theme as well.
And this is the one I thought was a theremin. I was like, this theme is
it's
so
cool
fucking
synthy,
it's got a theremin. For those of you who don't know, the theremin is the antenna-looking instrument that you change the pitch by changing your position, your hand position, and proximity.
The least reliable instrument.
Is it?
It's like playing a fretless bass.
There's that weedy sound. And again, he's only playing snippets of the themes. Mm-hmm. It's like a musical pastiche.
Yes. And he's building these tone clusters, this where you just kind of have a wall of sounds. How they just build up and they never let go. It's like someone playing the piano and keeping their foot on the pedal.
Yeah, and synthesizers, the, I guess, how do they describe it? Like, the sort of amplitude modulation trails off, so the decay is very long and holds on.
That spaceship sound. He's got it oscillating.
I don't recognize that last stinger.
Yeah.
So well. I don't know what that was exactly.
The end. It's a very cool theme, though, but there's a lot to it. A lot of people, I think, take sometimes this music at really, really face value, and that's fine. It's meant to be for the masses, right? And you don't always have to understand, like, oh, this is why I feel this way, or this is why this makes me uncomfortable. But when you do, sometimes it's very interesting. But then sometimes it's also very manipulative. Because you could say, like, just resolve the chord already. I know you're trying to. Which I think a lot of musicians have a huge problem, I think, with John Murphy in that way.
Okay.
And that's similar to a Wagnerian style where you're just like, just resolve the freaking chord. You've been playing this for like 5 minutes. I just want you to resolve the chord. And I think people like it because it pulls at your heartstrings, or it makes you feel something. And what that is it makes you feel the want for it to resolve.
Right. That's I wish I knew more about like music theory.
It's not useful. Don't
put
worry.
On my to-do list.
Well, you could always hang out with Yngwie. Yngwie says he knows everything there is to know about musical theory.
He sounds like a treat from what I've heard. Okay, so going into the nerdy side of the production of this. So Nightmare on Elm Street was originally temp scored with Gary Scott's score to the film Final Exam. I kind of felt like I'd probably seen a poster for Final Exam. I wasn't familiar with it, but I looked it up, and it was a 1981 slasher, and it is pretty generic looking. The trailer, I mean, it kind of looks like an American My Bloody Valentine in terms of production value. The score is a standout. Like, it doesn't really... Well, it makes as much sense as Gary Scott, the composer. This was his first professional gig. And Final Exam, the happier, more, you know, standard character moments, pretty boring stuff. But when he does transition into horror mode, you get a lot of the same kind of style Bernstein put into Nightmare on Elm Street. Mm-hmm. According to him, he didn't see the movie with the temp score. I think Wes Craven probably had a couple ideas that he liked and he wanted to communicate those. But again, like, you get the synthesizer pad that sort of underscores a lot of the musicality that goes over it.
Uh-huh.
You got piano. You've got some like other like weedier sounding synths, but you also get like some pretty cool programming and, you know, soundscapes. So when I was listening to, you know, in this case, there were YouTube clips of the soundtrack to Final Exam, I was impressed.
Yeah.
I was impressed that this 81 slasher had like a real character to it.
That's what I feel about Dead Silence. That's why I'm always going crazy about it, because the music really can make a film memorable.
Yeah, yeah. In this case,
it's
definitely
so
did.
Important.
Yeah. I've got funny detail. Gary Scott, so I mentioned that Final Exam was his first scoring gig. He went on to score Freddy's Nightmares, the TV show.
Yes.
The short run TV show. That was my joke, that it was the Circle of Life. But then he also scored 6 episodes of Seventh Heaven, which, I mean, we now know in hindsight that was kind of a horror show.
Yeah. Also similarly related to Freddy, right?
Ugh. Okay, so in terms of Nightmare on Elm Street, novelty and sort of in the world of music, are you more partial to the Fat Boys song Are You Ready for Freddy or Dawkins' Dream Warriors?
Dawkins. I'm always gonna go for Dawkins. Probably if it's the list, I'm probably gonna go with Dawkins.
I grew up with the Fat Boys. I think one of the Fat Boys' name is Darren, and I was like, there's another Darren out there, and so I was more partial to that one.
That's funny that we're on either side of it. To me, Dawkins is the natural choice.
I do like Dream Warriors. I do like that song a lot.
Right.
But yeah, the Fat Boys hold a gluttonous part of my heart.
You know, though, if I had to say for like a kitschy horror theme song, that Blob theme, that original Blob theme is probably one of the best things
the
I've ever.
Oh, the original. The like lounge.
The Bossa Nova.
Bossa Nova song.
That one is one of the best written with the title in it songs ever.
Yeah, that, what was the other one? The Green Slime?
Yes.
Well, I guess that was a whole thematic episode. There was the Green Slime, but also The Stuff had its own commercial.
There was some good stuff going on.
What is it about gelatinous ooze that really inspires brilliance?
You know, because Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles had a good song.
They did. Catchy as shit. I could probably still recite.
Something about ooze, man, really brings out the best in a songwriter.
Beware of the blob. It creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor, right through the door, all around the wall, a splotch.
So a lot of the John Carpenter details are taken from a interview he did on Medium.com. And this is how it starts. Once the editing for Halloween was complete, director John Carpenter went looking for feedback on his 1978 classic before releasing it to the general public. To get a sense of how the movie would play with audiences, he showed it to a Hollywood insider. Quote, I screened the final cut, minus sound effects and music, for a young executive from 20th Century Fox. He explained on his website. She wasn't scared at all. I then became determined to save it with the music.
Yeah, the music is that important.
It is. It is. And it kind of, it didn't start its own genre, but it was certainly like the first of these slashers that elevated the music mm-hmm. to like equal status.
Yeah.
Where, I mean, it was in his own words that it didn't really work.
Yeah.
On its own. John Carpenter worked with Dan Wyman a lot, his co-producer, who, by the sounds of it, is the more like technical musician. Would, if John Carpenter had a sound that, you know, or a riff that he was trying to get out, but, you know, it doesn't have the musicality mm-hmm. for it, then Wyman would take over. But it was those two guys in a studio in Hollywood working on pieces of music independent. Like, they had already, you know, made the film, so
right.
they knew pacing wise, they knew, you know, they needed a theme to drop here and go there. But they're writing music independent from the images from the film. And I think that's one of the reasons that like the Halloween theme, I feel, is a little different than the others because it is a little more pop music.
Uh-huh.
It is a little more constructed unto itself. But yeah, okay, so let's dive in. Carpenter also mentioned Bernard Herrmann, as well as Dmitri Tiomkin, who incidentally scored Hitchcock's earlier films, Dial M for Murder,
yeah,
as well as a bunch of Westerns, but also The Thing from Another World, which,
yes,
yeah, Carpenter's.
But, I mean, what, to me, where he really stands out, High Noon, he does encapsulate this idea and this Western theme, and he also did Giant, you know, which is a pretty great film. It's one of those always on the list.
I'm familiar with it as far as, like, I guess James Dean only did like 5 movies.
Yeah.
Forsake me, oh my dog.
So we're back at the computer and we're going to listen through John Carpenter's theme for Halloween.
Yeah.
Hit it, Mindy. So off, like, there's no soft lead in. We are just at the theme. We get the rhythmic, I think it's an arpeggiated synth that's doing the, like, what sounds to me like the 8th notes or 16th notes. And there is a light kick. But I guess the track is actually in 5/4. He talked about a bongo practice thing that his dad taught him just in terms of rhythms.
Mm-hmm.
And so the piano riff is actually in 5/4.
And the theme to Nightmare on Elm Street, that main theme, you hear it in a 5/4.
Oh, yeah?
Mm-hmm. It goes between 4/4 and 5/4.
Yeah, you've got
building
the rising,
this tone cluster.
Rising synths. Yeah, you had mentioned John Murphy before. I like a theme that builds, that mm-hmm. kind of gives you a basis. In this case, you've got the percussion that's just mechanical.
Mm-hmm. It's like Steve Reich. The way that it's approached is a very minimalist style to the percussion and to the underlying bit, but then you have this lush maximal practically. So you have the minimalist underneath and you have this maximalism kind of on top. Yeah. You have these just huge walls of sound, which is like, yeah, John Murphy, but it's we really associate it with Wagner, where it just takes forever to resolve. It just keeps building, building, building.
Yeah. Later for The Thing, we're going to talk about the Morricone's theme, Desolation. And kind of similar in terms of, like, picking a point on the horizon and having these rhythms that go towards it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got these building up passages. I think Morricone was more partial to, like, actual horns and strings.
Right.
But here we've got Carpenter doing digital strings with
synths.
Right. But it is a piano at the heart of it. And there is that subtle kick that kind of fades in and out, but it works on me.
It's
as
like
far
a
as
heartbeat.
Like a, yeah, or a predator's footsteps.
Oh, interesting that you think that. I think of it like the heartbeat.
You're still thinking John Murphy in a heartbeat.
There it goes.
And the fade out. Yeah. 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 I think it's far more structured than like the Bernard Herrmann psycho music. Like, he kind of has themes that work throughout, but there's, like, this seems like a pop music version of that.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, Carpenter's taking these themes, but he's at the heart of it, yeah, is that 5/4 is this kind of, like, unsettling, kind of driving percussion, and then layer this just lush and, like, thick kind of sound on top, which is, you just can't get that on anything besides real strings. You could get it, but there's something about hearing it on a synth and really hearing all those pieces working together. Mm. Because even if you were doing it on strings, the bow can only go so far before it comes back down. And there is a baby like breath kind of in between when the bow is coming up and down to hold out a long note. You can only do so much. Yeah. This is like, I mean, it's synthetic.
Yeah.
And that's what creates this almost like there's no breathing in it. There's no room to breathe. There's no need.
That's an interesting idea. I never really thought of electronic music as being synthetic for that reason, but there's not the like human pause that exists in a lot of other orchestral music.
It exists because that's how it is. You know, there's no way around it, but this is just a wall of sound coming at you, never ending.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting to think about. I hadn't really considered that. So for the gearheads out there, these days John Carpenter is very partial to Korg synths, but for the Halloween theme he used a Prophet 5 and 10. It seems like there was a drum machine in there somewhere. Yeah, these were essentially the same synths. Like he would finish a movie and then transition into like, all right, I'm in the mode to score music. Yeah, he did that for, I mean, we talked about it in depth last episode, but it really is kind of cool that like He is
a Renaissance man.
Yeah. What's the an auteur as well? Like he's got a perspective, and I think he probably didn't think of it in terms of like having his own style, especially in 78, where like Halloween is pretty early in his career, and so he talks about himself being the cheapest, fastest person he knows who could do the score. And like eventually, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. And before he knows it, like he kind of likes working in his own way. And
yeah,
he's got a sound all to his own.
And it's amazing because you listen to anything made, the most popular horror films that were being made, I would say 2014 to 2017. And you're going to hear that synth.
Yeah. Synth Nouveau. I've recently synth made a nouveau. Playlist that you know, recently finished up this current semester of grad school. And this was your last semester ever.
Of post-grad. Yeah. I'm done. So I have my post-master's certificate.
And congratulations. I'm a happy little...
Thank you.
That's so exciting.
I've taken a few music classes. I am done for a while.
You take a break. Well done. Well done. You rest.
I can sleep now.
You just sit in silence. You don't even listen to music. Really, just give your brain a vacation.
I know. That's why when you were like, can you listen to these? Can you look at these? And I'm like thinking to myself, like, well, do I have to do like a Roman numeral analysis for these pieces? Am I going to have to? What am I going to do? And then I looked at him. I was like, oh, no, I'm not going to do that.
So in this conversation, we mentioned there is a shape to the Halloween theme that we do kind of see come back into his work. Ironically, it was The Thing that was composed mostly, not exclusively, but mostly by Ennio Morricone. And so this was a piece I was curious to get your professional musician take on, because I think it left enough of an impact from when I was a kid watching the very opening credits. Like these days, it's very much driven into my DNA. Like I kind of imprinted from an early age on like liking a desolate, cold horror setting. Remote, the thing opens up with so much white. It's the inverse of space.
Yes.
And you've got this theme that is similarly desolate. And so I'm partial to this one. It does all the things I like. Okay. So there is a running theme to the, soundtrack and score to The Thing, tracks like Despair, Solitude, Sterilization, Contamination, and my favorite, Bestiality, which is spelled on paper as bestiality, but it's the same meaning.
Okay.
Incidentally, that track doesn't appear in the movie. Quentin Tarantino used it in Hateful Eight. And for that, Ennio Morricone wrote a bunch of original music. That was the first Oscar Ennio Morricone ever won. Like, how do you not give him the Oscar for Ecstasy of Gold is like the greatest Western epic piece of music. And that he, like all through his career, he was nominated but never won anything except for this Quentin Tarantino movie, which, like, whatever. I don't want to go
on a
tangent.
I think they did it because it was like, we've been overlooking this guy for all this time.
They did. He even got an honorary Oscar, which, like, kind of pandering.
Yes.
So at this point, it was kind of their opportunity to course correct and give him the Oscar for that. And whatever, I don't begrudge Morricone, but not Quentin Tarantino's best work. But okay, back to desolation, the main theme in The Thing.
Ready?
Yep.
And again, it sounds like Steve Reich at the beginning. That's what I think of.
The bass riff that starts on a single note, right?
Yeah.
And then it starts to build.
It's like very minimalist.
I'm hearing desolation. But I think that whenever I hear bass guitar. Yeah. It's got just enough reverb to sit in a space. Like, we don't... You know, it's certainly not like a recording studio room, but it kind of does float. And we've got the first sounds. Those are horns? Low horns?
Something.
Something. But now the bass riff is sort of built into something a little more complicated. Yeah, I think the horns playing the sort of ominous fade in and out.
The horns sound like the sighing theme from Psycho. It's like these two note phrases that go together. What's really weird to me about it is that the attacks are all different. Like, the attacks are not at the same time of the entrances for the instruments.
Okay.
It's like a stutter, like in phasing. It's almost like a phase on it. Badoop. See how it goes after? He resolves after?
At this point, I think we've got horns and synths playing the same layered part. Now we've got some higher parts. We've got some synth twinkles towards the top end.
Twinkles, I like that. How they resolve at different times. It's like a second behind the others.
Do you think of it as a mistake?
No, because I mean, it's Morricone, so I assume like he did it on purpose. You know what I'm saying? You can't imagine that. He was just like, we only get one take, here we go.
Chalk it up to layering.
It's like, why can't everyone come in on the right time? It must be on purpose, and it must be some idea of this phasing kind of feeling.
Of the sense we've got, that sounds like an organ. I think we mentioned the Hammond B3 organ was a pretty small enough to function in a lot of studios.
Plus, it gives you that great like gothic sound. See, and then there's that cluster that didn't seem like a reel. It seems like an accident, but it can't be.
Okay. I mean, it's there. it exists.
But I'm saying it can't be on accident. Everything, I assume, has some big reason. Especially in music as honestly complex and as involved, and there's so many parts, you can't imagine he didn't have his finger on every single part that's going on.
Yeah. I wonder if he sort of worked in sections where they're recording the orchestra for the horns and the strings, and then doing the studio synthesizer stuff independently. Yeah. So yeah, that was Ennio Morricone's Desolation, or the main theme to The Thing. So while Morricone gets the credit for the score, and I guess he should. Apparently, he only wrote 20 minutes of original music. Well, he wrote a lot of music.
He wrote, whole hour is what he says he wrote. 20 minutes was what Carpenter really used.
Yeah.
By divvying it up and splicing out throughout the film.
It's funny to think that the same thing with Halloween kind of happened again. Like, Morricone worked on the soundtrack on a couple musical ideas and then traveled played those for him.
If Morricone knows that Carpenter's going to keep doing this, well, the checks were clearing, I suppose. That was part of it. But it's like, why would you keep working with a person who keeps doing this?
Well,
because you compose, that's like your baby. And then it's essentially someone saying, like, I like your baby's hair color, but I don't like their face.
I'm going to give it a makeover. I'm going to give your baby a makeover. Yeah. I don't know. I have to imagine that composers, to have longevity in their careers, they have to be incredibly good at compromising and working, making work out of the art.
That's true, I guess.
Because film scoring is a component of popular art, and so you're gonna relinquish some amount of control.
Yeah, I mean, and it is a business. It's show business, not show play. And I get it, like, I get it, but, like, if someone keeps taking apart my baby, I'm gonna get mad.
Yeah, and it's a strange relationship that it began on the note of John Carpenter just being a huge Ennio Morricone fan and, like, going to him to do the music. And I guess even, like, playing some pieces that he had in mind for it. And Morricone going, like, you can do this. Why are you bringing it to me?
It's almost like he wanted Carpenter to do it all along. He was like, yeah, you can do that. It's cool. I don't have to do it. You're doing great.
Apparently, Carpenter got married to Morricone's music, which I wonder. I mean, I guess Carpenter's been married a couple times, but I wonder if that was Adrian Barbeau. And was that, like, a sign of, like, this ain't gonna work out. Like, this this guy's got some different ideas about what marriage is. It looks a lot like a horror movie.
Yeah, exactly. It sounds desolate. There's a lot of crunchy feelings in there.
He's gonna use words like desolation and bestiality and contamination and sterilization. On the note of Carpenter, just in the same universe of musicianship, I did want to give a shout out to Fangoria's own Werewolves in Siberia. Before I mentioned the Final Exam soundtrack, and while I was listening to that, I thought immediately back to an EP that Werewolves in Siberia had done called Slasher, and it was kind of an homage to a lot of the same, like, stylistic themes that we see in those movies, and, like, all the really great synth work and that, like, you know, sort of digital orchestration. Mm-hmm. The more I listen to his stuff, he's got a lot of albums on his Bandcamp page, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes. But yeah, Werewolves in Siberia. Lately, I've been listening to a lot. We started talking about finals and grad school, mm-hmm. and because I can't listen to music with vocals while I work, but I do like to have something on in the background, I did start listening to a lot of what you've deemed Synth Nouveau. That was the name of the playlist that I made. Bands like Survive, who had two tracks on the guest soundtrack. I think that was the first place.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. That was the first place I heard them. And they went on to do a lot of stuff for Stranger Things. They're an all-instrumental synth and drums band, similar to Magic Sword, which I'm a newcomer to.
Okay.
And so Magic Sword did a couple of the instrumental tracks in the Thor Ragnarok film.
Okay.
It's good. It's a little bit of a throwback to, like, 80s, not metal, although they do have some guitar work. But yeah, Magic Sword, bunch of guys who committed to a theme. Their website tells a tale. Like, okay, it really, it is some, like, Lord of the Rings by way of, like, synth rock. It's pretty fun.
I kind of like that, though. Like, I mean, I don't like it, but I've been listening to a lot of Ghost, and that's a similar, like, there's all these crazy stories and stuff, and you're like, none of this is real, but I kind of like the story more than even the music.
Yeah.
You know, I like this. So I get you. I feel you. Magic Sword.
And the last one was Gunship, which is synths plus vocals, but I did like their stuff a lot also. But yeah, let's transition to the big finale of The Grandfather.
So we have, I'm gonna say the Bach of horror movie music right here. Bernard Herrmann, and he probably most famous for Psycho. Obviously, he did a ton of films for Alfred Hitchcock. And we've talked about Psycho before. It was a Mother's Day episode we did last year, maybe?
2 years ago.
I don't know. Time seems to be very confusing to me.
2 years ago.
So we talked a lot about the music, just how great it is there. But there's a few things that you can listen to when you rewatch Psycho, because you should. Everyone should. It's got great rewatchability.
At least once a year.
Yeah, right. Every Mother's Day.
Mother's Day.
Exactly. There are some things I want you to start listening for when you listen to the music. And what you hear, the entire score, it's a very vast score that he has done. It's all set up into little kind of, you know how people storyboard stories?
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of storyboarded his whole score, his entire score.
Oh.
Separating it from exposition, inciting incident, complication, climax, resolution. And he keeps these themes, even though there's really 40 different kind of song cues, 40 different cues.
Wow.
He's keeping those similar themes for everybody. So, you know, there's the theme when she's driving down the road. There's that great, great driving music. Then there's the psycho. Obviously, we have the like kind of thing.
Yeah.
But we also have the psycho theme. The
yeah.
So that theme is the one I'm going to like focus on. We got to listen out for the psycho theme. That's one of those instances very similar to Nightmare on Elm Street, where they take the theme. That's the theme in its entirety. Do, 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 do. That's it. He'll repeat it. He'll reverse it. He'll split it up. He'll slow it down. That theme is throughout that entire time. Anytime you see Norman, you're going to be hearing a part of that theme. You're going to hear it in some way, shape, or form. And so there's a guy wrote an article out of the University of Arkansas. His name is Stephen Husarek, and he is, you know, a music theory guy. I don't know what their names are. I don't know what you call music
musicologist?
Theory. No. Musicologists would talk about, like, the social aspects. This guy's talking about the tonal theory.
Okay.
So I don't know what you call that guy. Smarty Pants McSmart Smarts.
I tried to be Smarty Pants McSmartson by just knowing the word musicologist.
Oh, good. Okay. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to knock you down. You can, but that's probably not the right answer. I know there's no wrong answers, but maybe that's less right.
Unless there
right.
are dumb ones.
But there's ones that are less right than others. Anyway, he has done this entire look at Bernard Herrmann's Psycho score, and he's broken it down for us. And he actually has this theory, which is amazing. So there's these chords you hear every now and then, and it's a minor chord on the bottom with a major seventh on top. And it's called a minor major chord, and it's a very unusual chord to our ears because we don't really hear it in Western music very often. He calls this chord the Hitchcock chord, and that's how he kind of refers to it. And what he says is, we know, we hear this theme when you're looking at the mother in the window and the mother's talking. And you hear this theme, and then you hear the Hitchcock chord on top of it. So it's telling us right there, once we hear this chord that sounds very uneasy to us, that that means something's wrong about this.
Okay.
So we know, okay, something's kind of wrong. Then when Marion gets murdered, this guy is saying, and he's right. I mean, if you look at it, I don't know. Sometimes you never know what was meant to be on purpose and what's being read into it after the fact. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
When Marion's being murdered in the whole like, the music playing in the background is also the psycho theme. So that whether you know it or not, you've already started to associate that theme with Norman. So he's saying that they gave away the entire spin of the film by playing it in the music.
Huh, okay.
So you're implied, like, you know it's someone you've met before because the music is familiar to you.
Right, right.
And that's that idea, you know, I hate to always refer to Wagner because I don't love Wagner, obviously, but he had these things called leitmotifs, and he, in opera, was one of the first people to be like, that's your theme, and when that guy walks on stage, his theme is playing, or when someone's thinking about that guy, their theme is playing.
Gotcha.
And that's kind of what Herrmann is doing with Psycho, is using these little mini themes, which he's given to everyone at the prelude, at the very beginning of the show. Hmm. Before we even meet everybody, he's like making us familiar, making us comfortable, sort of the way that Copeland did in that Appalachian Spring. It's using old American songs that people knew at the time then he makes this big song out of it. And people like hear five notes and they're like, oh, that sounds like something from my childhood. And that's kind of what Ehrman's doing. There, you know, you hear this theme and you go, oh, that sounds so familiar. Because right. you just you're, heard it 40 minutes ago.
And you're making associations between the musical themes and the characters you're watching on.
So the idea that he's giving away the ending right in the beginning is awesome. Like, how powerful is music? That's so cool.
That is really cool. That it reminds me of the point that the Swedish helicopter crew and the Thing are shouting about the dog early on as they're shooting at it. And if any of the American guys spoke, I think it's Swedish. I don't remember the joke that they're, you know, they're either Swedes or Finnish or I don't remember. But if any of them spoke the language of the other team,
the movie would be over.
There wouldn't be a movie. Yeah.
Right.
There would just be a lot of communication.
Yes.
And maybe some flamethrowers.
You know, I was talking about in many of the other songs that we keep coming back to, this sort of sighing theme, which is always present in the Psycho score. So we have this, it's kind of coming down a half step.
Okay, when you say sigh, all right, that makes more sense. So like almost like a pitch bend.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. So you're stepping down a half step. Sometimes he does a little bit more. But so you'll have whatever theme he's playing and then followed by a sigh, the sighing motif. And that's how you know, like, yes, I did just hear that. It, like, brings the listener back to it.
Okay.
The sighing motif, this guy is saying, which I don't know. No one owns minor seconds, right? They're... There's only so many things we can do. But he says
I have
that
four in my back pocket right now.
I own that minor second, damn it. But he's saying that John Williams then used the idea of the sighing theme, and that's where you get Jaws. Dee, dee, dee.
Right, right. And even in the build, the dun, 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 when it goes low.
Yeah. And it's literally the sighing theme. Coming, it's flipped around.
I'm sure there's probably a lot of people listening to this and going like, oh, like in that other movie.
Exactly, like, exactly. I mean, that's why I'm saying like no one can own minor seconds, but I mean, I guess you could say Ehrman was the first to use it in a spooky way maybe that got on film.
It's really interesting that Psycho kind of, it comes back around as being one of these, I mean, I'm not enough of a completist to say that it's definitively the first movie that used the music in the forefront to, I mean, kind of piggyback the tone. Mm-hmm. Like, I would have a very hard time watching Psycho without the music or even just as a, you know, a silent film and be able to absorb, you know, half of the tension that's really in the final product, and that the music does so much to, like, carry the film. That feels unique. That feels like pretty early in the process.
Right. And we go very back to the very beginning, what we were talking about, and you hear those upbeats, kind of that upbeat.
Like Sublime. Like
exactly. And it gives you, though, this like anxiety and this like...
You're calling attention to the offbeat note.
Yes. Downstroke. There's something about the tonality when it's used in these films where you just gives me like agitation.
Is that... Does your relationship to music sometimes take you out of a horror movie? Is that why you're more partial to like familiar pop music in the background?
I don't know why. I mean, sometimes I think though it is great, but if it's something very complex, like I remember listening to some of the Hammer films and those are so complex. You're just listening to so many things. That's hard to pay attention to a movie and listen to a tonal sequence. Like listening to 14-tone sequences and trying to pay attention to a movie where people are talking and stuff is very difficult.
Yeah, how the music is also mixed in a scene. I don't know. We're talking about the compromises a musician makes when they take on a project, something big like a film. It's all great and fun when you're in the studio and you're just like, it's working. This is fantastic. And then the filmmaker might chop it up.
Right.
I mean, Carpenter spread out an hour's worth of music over 20 minutes of The Thing. And like, I guess Ennio Morricone probably has to, I mean, after a career's worth of scoring a film, he's probably good at going like, it's your thing. Go ahead.
Yeah. It's yours now. I don't know. I think the why I love some of my most favorite movies though, is because of their relationship with the music and the film, and they're so seamless or they're so perfect together. I think I'll never forget when I watched 28 Days Later in the movie theater. And I was like, this is a like rock opera horror film thing, music video. It's all the things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's how I feel about Sunshine. And that's how I feel about Psycho.
Interestingly, Herman, for as prolific as he was, and he did everything from Citizen Kane to the very early The Day the Earth Stood Still, The Man Who Knew Too Much, The Wrong Man, Vertigo, North by Northwest, Jason and the Argonauts, and Taxi Driver. I mean, those are just a handful. And apparently he was a real asshole. Like, he was not easy to work with at all.
I could imagine. It's very complex stuff.
It's kind of the price you pay for genius, right?
Yeah, those guys get to be real assholes.
It's like, yeah, like the crazy successful chefs all turn out to be maniacs.
Yeah, I feel like
to be that good at something.
If Ehrman had given some of this to John Carpenter and John Carpenter cut it up, and didn't use most of it, like, there would have been
a bomb.
Hell like, to pay. Yeah, I think he wouldn't have gone like, okay.
To look forward to working with you the next time.
Yeah,
wink.
I think that would have been it.
Right. I guess that also puts a lot of pressure on the filmmaker. I mean, that's partially why it's so surprising how chopped up John Carpenter, and I guess even just Morricone apparently produced a lot of like non-synthesizer music for the film. And so, like, John Carpenter took, like what, a fourth
pretty
of
much only
the music
synthesizer stuff
that he
too.
Ever made? Yeah. Yeah, wow.
But, I mean, if not, then you have... I mean, there has to be a great relationship with the director and the composer, because if not, you have the Exorcist situation.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that happens enough where someone gets fired for doing a dissatisfying job.
Artistic differences are very real.
So that'll wrap up this part two of The Sounds of Horror.
I hope it's not too boring. Music theory is not really fun, but it's so cool when you get into it.
I enjoyed myself, and I only knew like every fourth word you said.
Excellent. Me too.
But yeah, so we'll probably be back with one last part of this Sounds of Horror.
Less technical next time, probably.
Yeah, I think
don't
probably.
Don't worry, guys. Don't worry, listeners.
But on that note, get in touch with us. Drop us a review on iTunes,
give
on
us
Stitcher.
Stars. Give, give, give.
Yeah. So speaking of music, we do have a whole section of our website for music where we've got songs old and new that we've worked on together and some instrumentals. And I'm trying to figure out how to get it to be downloadable. At the moment, you can only play from the website, but I'll figure that out. If not, whatever. Listener, if you want any of the music, I'll happily email you. The tracks, our email is therantsmacabre@gmail.com.
That was seamless right there.
Yeah, synergy.
Yeah.
What else? We're on all the social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter @rantsmacabre. Yeah, we'll see you next time for part three of our Sounds of Horror. This is me, Darren, signing off.
This is Mindy. Thanks.